What if your vegetable garden didn't just boom in August specifically? We all know you plant everything in the beginning of the growing season, and then come August, you've got more produce than you can dream of. But then it kind of ghosts you for the rest of the year, right? Well, today I'm joined by horticulturist and author Charlie Nardozzi to talk about his continuous vegetable garden method. He uses perennials, self-sowing plants, and smart succession planting to make the most low-maintenance garden I've ever heard of. It's more harvest and less work. By the end of this episode, you're going to learn how to stretch your season even in cold climates, plant once and harvest for years, and let nature do the heavy lifting. Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to Growing Joy.
It's nice to be here, Maria. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm very curious about your methodology that you preach, because it almost sounds too good to be true with this continuous vegetable garden that we all would love to have. I'm curious, how did you become the plant person and continuous gardening expert that you are today?
Well, it goes way back to my childhood. I grew up in Connecticut, and my Italian grandparents, every time one of their six children got married, they gave them a piece of land on their property. So I grew up with the Italian-American enclave, all my uncles and aunts and cousins all around us. And of course, because it was a farm, there's a big farm there, but my mother and her brothers and sisters always had their own little vegetable gardens. So I grew up with gardening all around and helping my mom in the spring plant her vegetables, picking rocks and picking and harvesting some of the vegetables there. It's an Italian family, you know, food is really central to all of your life. So I really kind of had it, I got it in my DNA, and I got inundated with it at a young age. And I continued to study and went to the University of Vermont, got a degree in horticulture, a master's in education, and then eventually started writing books and writing articles. And it's been kind of an evolution. I started with the way my grandparents would grow, garden, and my mother would garden, which is you'd plow the soil, and then you put down some fertilizer, like a 10-10-10, for example. And then you put all your plants in there. And if there's any bugs or problems, you just dust them with 7 dust. And that was it. I just kind of assumed that's how you grew things. And even going to school for horticulture, the mentality was more or less the same, even though organic gardening and organic farming was becoming more popular. But it wasn't until I actually was doing my own gardening and my own research that I really started diving into other ways you can garden. One of them is using no-dig gardening or lasagna gardening, which I wrote another whole book about. And I have a brief summary chapter in this book because I think soil is that important. And then also, as we kind of went through the years, my wife and I at our garden, we kind of noticed different things were happening, things that made gardening easier and made it more sustainable and less work for us. And yet we were still getting acceptable harvests of vegetables, herbs, fruits, and those types of things. So that's kind of why I put this whole book together. It's pulling in lots of different ideas that I've learned about and that I've experienced over my years gardening and putting them all in one place so you can have a system that will actually work for you in your yard.
Yeah, we have very similar upbringings. My grandparents lived in Queens, and they had a plot. They were Italian immigrants, and they had a plot of land for their house and then the plot of land next to their house, which they had for their garden. Mm-hmm. And my grandma grew everything they ate in it. She had meticulous rows of tomatoes. I mean, meticulous rows of plants. And then she would jar and can everything she grew because, you know, when you're in the Northeast, you have a very limited growing season. But this idea of a continuous garden, you know, that isn't just if you're in the Northeast, you know, May, June through September, only getting tomatoes in, you know, August, or only really growing food that you can really eat, you know, 90% of your meals out of in the summertime. How did you in Connecticut, which is also, you know, what zone are you in, like 5 or 6?
We're zone 5, yeah.
Yeah. So how in Connecticut did you start stretching that growing season and coming up with this continuous practice?
Well, with the continuous garden, we're looking at ways to grow things so you can have them throughout the growing season, for sure, but not getting into that boom and bust cycle that you often will get when, especially with new gardeners starting out. They'll plant a row of beans in May, for example, in our climate, and then 60 days later, they got a ton of beans for about 1 or 2 weeks, and then that's it for beans. And so then you have to move on to something else. So that kind of cycle that keeps going. So in this book, what I ended up doing is taking a look at, first of all, things that are going to make it easier for you, like perennial vegetables. We know about asparagus for sure. We know about rhubarb for sure. But there are lots of other perennial vegetables that you can grow in the onion family, in the broccoli, brassica family, that's going to allow you to not even have to think about planting these every year, because they're going to come right back up and they're going to produce for you sometimes over time too. So that's one way to reduce the work you're doing. Another way you can reduce what you're doing is doing self-sowing vegetables. And I got turned on to this at one of my radio shows many years ago when I was a budding horticulturist. And I was on the radio and this older gentleman called me, Charlie was his name. And he said, I've got a way that I plant my lettuce that you might be interested in. And he says what he does is goes out in March in Vermont and sprinkles the seed on top of the snow on top of his beds where he wants the lettuce to grow. And then, of course, the snow would melt. And he said that lettuce would actually grow up and produce sooner than any other lettuce he ever planted when he waited till May or so to plant it. I didn't at first believe it until I tried it, and then it actually worked. And so we've been doing a lot of self-sowing of our vegetables and herbs now. We let things naturally go to seed, like lettuces, arugulas, kales, mustards, all different kinds of greens that you can grow. And by letting them go to seed, they will drop their seed. And if you're in a long enough growing season, you'll actually get a fall crop of that lettuce, for example. If not, you'll probably get a spring crop or an early spring crop. And the nice thing about letting the seeds grow up when they want is that nature knows when the perfect conditions are there for germination. They know if the moisture and the sun and the temperature is all right. Whereas we're guessing most of the time in the spring, is it too early? Is it too late? What can be happening? So we end up getting all these free plants that are just self-sowing throughout the garden. And then we become a garden editor. We start moving things around to be where they want them to be. And of course, thinning a lot of things out. If you have a lot of dill, for example, or calendulas, you're probably going to have many more seedlings than you're going to need. So you have to do a little thinning out. But it reduces the labor, reduces the cost, and makes for a more fun garden. So that's kind of where we start with our garden. And then we move into using techniques like succession planting, interplanting, companion planting, to have that continuous harvest of the vegetables right through the season. And I have illustrations in the book that actually show the steps on how to do that.
Yeah, because I feel like before, when I've heard of, you know, I feel like the only thing that I had heard of before your book is succession planting, right? That's a practice my mom intuitively did. Like, you'd buy the basil plant at the store, you'd plant it, and then you'd also plant some seeds around the established basil plant. So by the time you had used up the basil plant that was already established and planted, the seedlings have come in and now you have another yield, you know, this like continuous crop of plants. So when you were talking about this story about Charlie, he manually sprinkled lettuce seeds on the snow, but that self-sowing strategy is when you just let your lettuce bolt the seeds from the lettuce, sprinkle down to the ground over winter under the snow, and then they're the first things to germinate.
Exactly.
Is that the difference?
That's the difference. Yeah, Charlie kind of opened my eyes to the idea of it's not just about waiting till May to plant all your seedlings. There's different ways to do this. And then we started just leaving a couple lettuce plants, I use lettuce as an example, to just self-sow. And I noticed how quickly they come up in the spring. And what's nice about it is that you can be a little more proactive too. You could just let the seeds drop where they will, and that's fine. Then you move them around, weed them out, whatever. Or you can wait till the seed head starts forming and then cut it off and take that whole seed head over to a bed where you want lettuce next year and just sprinkle it around in there, or just leave it. I just drop it sometimes. I do that with our sunflowers. It's another one that self-sows. But we always have extra sunflower heads. You know, the birds get some, the chipmunks get some, the mice get some, but there's always some seeds left. And so I take some of those cut heads, I put them over in a different part of the garden where I want sunflowers the next year. The seeds drop and they germinate, and lo and behold, next year I've got a bunch of little baby sunflowers over in that area.
Wow, that's so cool. What are some perennial edible plants that gardeners are overlooking when it comes to that? Because this idea of a perennial vegetable garden, I mean, when you think about vegetable gardening, most people, like our Italian, you know, grandparents, go get their seedlings or start their seeds, and they're planting annuals every single year. And this idea that you could plant an edible plant once and then come back to it every year and be eating from it and not really having to worry about it, that's really appealing. So what are some perennial plants that people might not be considering when they're grabbing for their tomatoes and basils and herbs, you know, and eggplants that they should be considering taking up real estate in their garden?
Yeah, absolutely. So the obvious ones that people know and probably already planting are things like rhubarb and asparagus. Those are perennials, come up every year, and it's really simple. But as I was mentioning before, there are some in other plant families. For example, in the onion family, there are bunching onions that are evergreen. Actually, one's called evergreen hardy. And these are the scallions or green onions. And if you leave them out there, you just don't harvest them all like we normally do, they will form into a mature plant. Then next year, they'll come up and they'll have all these little baby plants around the mature plant. And now those are the ones you can harvest, or you can take some off and replant them. And that way you can have those green onions longer into the season. And they come back every year, every year. There's another onion called the Egyptian or walking onion. And this is a kind of a bigger plant. And it grows up and it has what we call a top set of little bulbs, little onion bulbs on the top of each one of the leaves, you might call them. And when they get big enough and heavy enough, it'll bend down that leaf and so that those bulbs touch the ground. And wherever they touch the ground, they'll root. And so over time, you'll watch how that onion starts literally walking across your garden. And it's very prolific. You can get these little baby onions that you can eat. They're edible, but they are kind of small. It's like the size of a shallot. I usually use this variety for green onions in the spring, because they're one, again, being a perennial, they're one of the first things that comes up in the spring. You can get a lot of nice harvests of green onions for cooking. And then I just kind of let it go. And some of these, like the rhubarbs and these Egyptian walking onions, can actually take over a space. So one of the other things you have to be aware of is if you have that kind of perennial, you're going to have to probably cut it back in the spring. And we dig up some of our rhubarb every year and give away big clumps of it, divisions of it. And you do the same thing with the Egyptian onions. But that's another example. There are perennial broccoli and kales. Broccolis and kales used to be perennials. And then with all the breeding that's happened to them, they're more either annuals or biennials. But there are some kales that are hardy and grown in Vermont. One was called cosmic kale, very beautiful little plant, but with green and golden edged leaves. And it grew into a little shrub, maybe a foot or two tall and wide. And every spring it would start leafing out. And that's when I would pick it for the nice tender greens. And then right through the growing season, you could pick at it anytime you want to cook it as a kale green. The same is true for some of the broccolis. There's one called purple sprouting that has purple shoots that come up. And the shoots are small. They're kind of like a broccolini, that kind of size head to them. Mm-hmm. But they come up continually. And again, it's a perennial. So it comes back year after year after year. And the final one I just want to mention quickly is the wine cap mushrooms. This is a fun one.
I loved seeing that in your
book. Yeah, Strepharia, which is this beautiful, looks like a portobello mushroom. And I know a lot of people love to either forage for mushrooms or maybe even try to grow some of them. But there's always a concern about, is it a friendly mushroom? Is it poisonous? All of that kind of thing. Nice thing about this is that it's very distinct and you can grow it in a bed. So I first started by growing it in, a 4x6 bed with wood chips in it and put some of the spawn or spore in it. Watered it really well for a week or two and put it in a part shade area and just left it there. If you do that in the spring, you'll get mushrooms in the fall. If you do it in the fall, you get mushrooms in the spring. And so what happens is they come up and you get a bunch of different harvests of these mushrooms over time. And if you add a little more wood chips, you can kind of keep it going. But the fun thing is, if you let some of those mushrooms just mature and send their spore out, you'll start seeing these wine cap mushrooms all over your landscape, underneath your blueberries, in the pathways, near some shrubs, because they just pop up wherever the right environments are and they're completely edible. So you can really have some fun with this. Go ahead.
Do they need a different media? So when you put it in the bed, you mentioned wood chips. Mm-hmm. Can you inoculate a garden bed that has your lettuces and your tomatoes and your rhubarb with wine caps, or it needs to be in a specific bed that is mostly wood chips, different media?
It likes a lot of organic matter. Yeah, you can't just have soil there. You'd have to have a bed that maybe is mulched with some wood chips or some heavy carbon material, because that's really what the mycelia needs to be feeding on in order to grow. But it will find the spots, like I was mentioning, you know, underneath the shrub or over an asparagus patch or something like that. It'll find spots where it'll be able to flourish.
This episode of Growing Joy with Plants is brought to you by Manicora Honey, the richest, creamiest, most delicious honey I have ever had. It's why I've been talking about this product on my podcast for like 2 years now. If you've been listening, you know that I love Manicora Honey in my coffee every morning. I use it as a dupe for that brown sugar shaken espresso. And sometimes often in the afternoon, I'll pair it with some cheese or an apple as a snack. When I'm saying honey, you might be rolling your eyes being like, Maria, what the heck? You're picturing some sort of like honey bear shaped honey bottle at the supermarket. That's not what this is. It's single origin honey. And Manicora honey is actually honey that's come from bees that gather nectar at the Manuka tree, which is packed with bioactives that give this honey 3 times more antioxidants and prebiotics than regular honey. It is totally a game changer. And all you need is 1 heaped teaspoon each morning to get the most out of all of those amazing bioactives. Plus, it tastes like caramel. It's so freaking good. It doesn't taste like any other honey you've tried. And now, if you want to try Manicora honey, it's never been easier. All you got to do is head to manicora.com/bloom to save up to 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts with the starter kit. It comes with the MGO 850 plus Manuka honey jar, honey travel sticks, which are great. I take them on like long weekends, a wooden spoon, and a guidebook. So that's manicora.com/bloom to save 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts. manicora.com/bloom.
That's so cool. And yeah, you can inoculate logs too. So you could have, you know, a log pile with whatever types of, you know, mushrooms you want. We did that when we used to live in the Catskills. We had, was it reishi mushrooms? We inoculated some sort of edible mushroom in a log, which was really fun.
Yeah, yeah. Shiitake mushrooms are popular for that as well. Yeah, that's a whole process to doing that. But it is yet another way you can kind of have this edibility in your yard without having to create another bed or create a big garden.
So how do you know whether or not a plant is perennial near you? You know, I didn't know how good I had it when I lived in zone 5B in the Catskills. I recently moved to zone 10B in South Florida. And now I'm realizing like I can't grow half the stuff that I have been growing for years and years in upstate. And there are things that are perennials for me that aren't perennials for you. So how do you figure out, especially with the edibles, what is a continuous plant for yourself?
Well, you do have to kind of look at what regions of the country you're in. You know, this book is really kind of talking about people who have a winter. If you're in zone 10B in South Florida, it really, some of it doesn't even make sense because as you say, some things like the rhubarb won't even grow there, whereas you have tomatoes, which will grow forever, or peppers, which will grow forever there because you never get a frost to kill them. So I think it all is about finding out locally what's growing in your area. And for the perennials, you know, it's going to vary for sure. For the self-sowing things, it may not vary. It might vary on the timing of it. And maybe you grow lettuce in the winter, for example, in a warmer climate. So you can let it self-sow and then get a spring crop of it. Versus having it self-sow in the fall and then you get a winter crop or something like that. So it'll vary in timing-wise, but as far as what you're growing, it may have to change as well.
Mm-hmm. But turn to your local garden clubs or garden centers or botanical gardens to figure that out.
Exactly.
Let's talk about self-sowing a little bit more, because I think that's really interesting. Once again, like the idea of having an edible garden that is not that much work is so appealing. So perennials, obviously, the least work with, like you said, you have to divide them and give them away or move them around your garden, you know, every couple of years. This self-sowing idea of having plants sow themselves and you don't even need to deal with it. Like, what are some of the best self-sowing plants for an edible garden that you would suggest people try?
Yeah, so a lot of the leafy greens that I was mentioning, the lettuce, the arugula, plants of that nature, mustards, really easy to have self-sow. Some of the edible flowers, marigolds, calendulas, nasturtiums, sunflowers that I mentioned, those are really easy as well. And you can play around with some things that might be take a little more time. Some of the biennials, like the beets and the Swiss chards and the carrots, those are a little more involved as far as getting them to self-sow. You take their tomatoes. And that I have a word of caution, of course, in the book about getting those tomatoes that are popping up in your garden or in your compost pile from last year's fruit. If they're a hybrid variety, they're not going to come true to seed, so you're not going to get the same variety. But if they're an heirloom variety, especially if they're cherry tomatoes, like an heirloom variety such as Matt's Wild Cherry, tomato. These varieties tend to kind of stay within themselves, you might say. You can actually prevent it from cross-pollinating by simply going out there and doing the pollination yourself with a Q-tip and then covering that flower cluster with maybe a mesh bag or something so no bees can move the pollen around. But some of these heirloom varieties will stay relatively true to seed. So you can play around with those. You just have to be careful about the crossing and the diseases that might be with them. So I always have a word of caution when I talk about saving things like tomato seedlings. If you see any kind of signs of disease on them, it's better just to rip them out and start with a new batch.
And seed saving. So, well, with self-sowing. So a true self-sowing plant is a plant that you're not interfering with at all, right? They're, you know, it's the fennel that has its beautiful flowers that turn into those beautiful seed heads. And then the seed heads are just naturally going to drop when a bird comes to try and eat some of them. They're going to drop to the soil and overwinter and then sprout and grow again. Is there any, like, should we be helping our plants? Like you said, like cutting a sunflower head off and then moving it around? Or like, are there any other practices with this kind of method besides like chopping and dropping that beginners should know about?
As I was mentioning, a lot of times these plants will self-sow rampantly. So you'll get a ton of calendulas, calendula I think of, because that's one we always seem to be weeding out in the spring, that are growing there. If you don't want that to happen, the thing to do is, of course, go in the previous summer when they're blooming and don't let them go to seed. And once the flower passes, just deadhead them. So you could do things like that to reduce the amount of seeding that you're getting. But for me, it's just as easy to go in the spring and just kind of weed it out with a hoe. Some of the little seedlings that I don't want to have there. So keeping that in mind, letting it self-sow that way, cutting them and moving them around, or you can still collect seed. You mentioned seed saving. I have a section or a chapter in the book about seed and plant saving, giving you some basic steps on that. You can go ahead and just save the seed yourself and then plant it in a regular way. So it doesn't necessarily mean you don't have to do that. I'm just trying to make it easier to just let things self-sow at the same time.
Yeah, so by seed saving, you mean manually saving them, putting them in an envelope, having them in your house, and then just using them like a normal seed packet the following year.
Exactly, yes.
That's so cool. What does your garden look like?
Our garden, well, we have a number of gardens because I do some filming and things here too. So we have a lot of different kinds of plants. But the main garden area that started as a vegetable garden way back when we started is now kind of evolved. It's really interesting to look at old photos and you see all these beds. Some of them are raised beds, some of them are in the ground, and they're all just vegetables, 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 maybe a few herbs here and there. Now, if you look at our garden, it is a whole diverse ecosystem of plants. There's certainly vegetables and herbs in there, but we have fruit bushes, we have climbing vines growing up. We have some shrubs in there. We have fruit trees. We have ornamental plants in there. It's a whole mix. And what we're trying to do is garden more in an ecologically friendly way. And in nature, you see that there's a whole diversity of plants that's in an area. You don't just have all one plant unless people planted it that way. So we're trying to recreate that kind of feel in there. And with the idea that you're going to have less insect problems, less disease problems, and of course, less things you have to worry about. So our garden is a big diversity of things. It's all in raised beds now. We've kind of gotten away from trying to work our clay soil after years of working at it. So everything's in raised beds, and we practice the no-dig gardening method that I mentioned earlier to keep the soil healthy, kind of mimicking what happens in nature, where we don't turn or till the soil, but we allow organic materials to come onto that soil, either ones we put there, or if we just chop and drop a healthy plant at the end of the season. Then in the spring, we bring in compost, so just cap it off a little bit, and then plant right through it. And that seems to work really well. Plants are growing really strongly, don't have as many weeds, and is less work involved. So that's the main garden that's kind of referenced by this book.
That's so cool. I love you mentioned the visual layouts in the book where you talk all about, you literally have layouts of different beds and what you can plant and, you know, throughout the season, what gets replaced and whatever, so that you can succession plant and have this continuous garden. What are some of your favorite, maybe in your own beds or ones that you've tried in the past that you feel like have been really successful for this continual approach? What are some of your favorite plant combinations for a bed?
Sure. Yeah. I like using legumes. So it could be beans and peas. Edamame is another one. So one of my favorite combinations is having, again, we're thinking continuous. So we're not planting whole beds of beans. We're planting maybe a row of beans that will replant another row in a couple weeks and then a row after that. You know, we're kind of having it staggered. So in a bed, say an 8-foot long bed, part of that bed, maybe 4 feet of it, will have a row of beans, a row of kale in the center, and then a row of edamame on the other side. So you have three rows in this raised bed, and only going about 4 feet. And then the rest of that bed could be root crops. It could be eggplants. It could be something else that you're growing. What I like about this is that the beans will grow up. You harvest those. And of course, beans and edamame being legumes, they're fixing atmospheric nitrogen so that the plants can use that. And then the kale kind of just, I wouldn't say sit dormant, but it's just kind of just hanging out there in between. And it's actually protected away from the cabbage worm butterflies because it kind of gets covered over a little bit by the beans and the edamame. Once the beans are done in about 60 days, roughly, and you're not getting much production out of them, that's when I chop and drop them. That means I take a hedge trimmer, a manual hedge trimmer, chop it all down into little pieces and leave it right there on the ground. What that does is it opens up an opportunity for these kales to start growing. And then once the edamame finishes, which is usually about maybe a few weeks or if not a month later from the beans, I do the same thing for that. And then we have mulch around the kale. And then by now we're in August, early September, and the kale just takes off. It gets the nitrogen and it gets all the air, and it's a cooler temperature, so it likes to grow. So there's three crops that I get there from just kind of planning it out a little bit better and not really having to make them separate plants in separate places.
Right, in one spot, which would have just been designated for beans or edamame right. or lettuce.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's actually possible to have a primarily perennial food garden?
I think it's possible. You know, in my book, I talk about a lot of unusual things that you can eat too, just to kind of open up the possibility, things like daylilies, daylily flowers, daylily buds, daylily roots, and also hostas, little shoots of hostas. Actually, it's a delicacy in Japan. When they first come out of the ground, they would harvest them when they're about 3 inches or so, 3-4 inches tall, and then saute them with salt and butter and pepper, and they taste delicious, actually. So I do, if you're willing to expand what you think about as food and how you do that, you could have mostly a perennial vegetable garden. Things that I would call it more a perennial edible garden, because I would throw herbs, of course, into that whole mix too, because there's a lot of great edible herbs, of course, out there.
And I guess more of like a survival garden, like foods that you can eat, but not the tomato, like not the classic, like tomato and basil that you think, you know, you're supposed to grow in an edible garden, but like plants that you can grow and that you can survive and eat and enjoy.
Right. And a lot of these could be very productive, like Jerusalem artichokes is one I mentioned in there. And that's a big sunflower.
Yes, I was excited. I was excited to see that. I love Jerusalem artichokes and you don't see people write about them. So yeah, tell us a little bit more about how to grow those.
Yeah, so these are plants, if you're not familiar with them, have nothing to do with Jerusalem or artichokes.
Yes.
But they're in the sunflower family.
Otherwise known as sunchokes.
Sunchokes, it's a better name for them. Uh-huh. They are a long season plant, so you're not going to really do anything with this plant until the fall. They'll grow up. They're like a sunflower, and they have these little beautiful sunflowers flowers on them in late summer. But what you're really interested in eating is the roots, because what happens is that the roots form tubers, kind of like a potato. And so when you're ready to eat these, usually in the fall, you can cut down the plant. You can start digging around and pulling out these tubers. And you don't have to worry about reducing the amount of plants you have for next year by taking too many tubers, because you'll never find them all. And in fact, once you have the Jerusalem artichoke in a garden, it's never going to leave, because even if you leave a half of a tuber behind, it's going to sprout up the next year. So you have to be a little bit careful with it. But what's nice about them is you have these tubers that you can use like potatoes. They can be kind of knobby. Some of the newer varieties are a little more smooth skin, a little easier to peel, clean, that kind of thing. But they can be used the same way you'd use potatoes. You can boil them, you can roast them, you can use them in lots of ways. And of course, they come back the next year again, so you can harvest them another time.
I feel like they're like so much better than kohlrabi, but kohlrabi is like another kind of root vegetable that everybody grows. But sunchokes are so delicious. They're so like kind of sweet.
Yes, they have a nice sweetness, especially if you wait till after a frost or so and the ground starts getting cool, then you have a nice sweetness to them.
What about other root? Are there other root vegetables that are perennials, or those are harder because you're harvesting the roots? So you're kind of ruining the plant, like potatoes, sweet potatoes.
Yeah, those I talk about those in the book, and they're not really true perennials in the sense that they're the same plant is going to come back the next year. But any tubers that are in the soil, and people will obviously see this in their gardens, they will sprout up if you forget to harvest them or you miss them the next year, depending upon where you live in the winter and all of that. So you can make them into perennials by selecting, kind of like garlic is the same way this way. So you can harvest them. You clean them all up, you cure them, you do all the things you normally do to store them into the winter, but you also take some of them away from the ones you're going to be eating, and those will be your crop for next year. And so next spring, those will be the ones you will plant back in the garden. If you do that year after year, you'll end up getting a variety that's more adapted to your climate, your temperature, your soil, all those things, and so it'll grow better. We've been doing it with garlic for years, and we've been selecting for larger cloves and larger bulbs and larger cloves. And so now we get some beautiful bulbs and cloves that have all large cloves in them because we've been selecting for that year after year.
That's interesting. So it's almost akin to seed saving, but with the potatoes or
right,
the garlic.
With the garlic or the potatoes or the sweet potatoes, you can save some sweet potatoes, let them sprout in the spring. And those are those sprouts that come up. You just cut them off the main plant, root them, they root really easily, and then you have your potato, your sweet potato plant for that year.
Yeah. Any quick tips that you have for people who might want to, you know, I am famous for at the end of the season harvesting the basil seeds or the fennel seeds or like harvesting the seeds. I put them in like a little ramekin. I forget to label them and they just kind of like sit out and like never get replanted because I don't end up labeling them and like properly storing them. But the intention is there. I'm trying to do it. So what are some like quick tips for people who might want to try that kind of method of like taking your best sweet potatoes and overwintering them or taking those garlic cloves, like et cetera, et cetera? Like what are some other tips you might want to offer?
Sure. So if you're doing seeds or plants, you always, of course, want to choose seeds and tubers from the healthiest plants you have. You want to avoid anything that's diseased. That's just kind of a no-brainer. As I mentioned before, no hybrid varieties, if that's an issue with whatever you're growing, because the seed part will not come back that way. And then just following those steps of curing them, you know, pulling them out of their roots, like potatoes and sweet potatoes. You want to cure them for a couple of weeks so they toughen up their skin, or storing them under the right conditions. For potatoes and sweet potatoes, they're like a more humid 35, 40 degree kind of situation, which you can kind of create in a basement if you have like a big plastic box where you can put some organic materials in there that are moist. It'll kind of keep it a little bit more humid. Garlic is really easy. All we do is we put it in the basin underneath a clay pot. So we flip a clay pot over upside down, you put them in there, and that holds enough moisture that's going to keep our garlic literally for a year. We harvest it in July, and the next July, we're still eating it. In fact, we're tossing it because we are getting our other crop coming in. So it lasts a long time that way. And with the seeds, of course, you want to always store them in a cool, dry place. Usually in glass jars are nice, and yes, Maria, do label them. That does help, unless you can really identify those seeds. Some seeds are really obvious and others not so much.
No, mine are not so much. Mine just end up getting totally like tossed in the compost bin.
Well, you could do something I've done with those kinds of seeds where you're not sure what they are, or you just have extra seeds. I have one of those beds you're talking about in the illustrations. One of them is what I call a polyculture bed, where I have tomato plants, and then in between the tomato plants, I had all these old green seeds, you know, arugula, mizuna, Asian stir-fry greens, basil, all these. I mixed them all together, threw them in between the plants when I planted the tomatoes, and lo and behold, a month or so later, we're eating all these greens from this garden, and the tomatoes are just chugging along, you know, they're just doing their thing. And eventually, the tomatoes got so big that they actually shaded out the greens, but we got all these harvests of greens from that garden. Once the tomatoes got big, the plants just died down and mulched the soil. I didn't have as many weed problems there, and the tomatoes did fine.
I love that idea of having like an oopsie bed.
Yes,
just being like a bed. surprise me bed. Just
that's right.
Sprinkling seeds blindly and being like, what's here? What is this? I don't know.
Right.
I love that. Well, if people are interested in this, you know, methodology, your book is a great resource. Like I said, I'm such a visual learner. So anybody who has a book that has like actual illustrations and instructions with a visual is so helpful for me. And I feel like just your beds, you know, the bed illustrations are so valuable. But where can everyone find you and your book?
Well, you can find me at gardeningwithcharlie.com. That's Charlie with an IE at the end. Gardening with Charlie, all one word, .com. That's my website. And you can also find the book online. You can find the book in bookstores. It is out now. And I'll be traveling around the country doing talks. And you can find out all that information, too, online.
Very cool. Yes, I'll see you in Seattle in a few weeks.
Yes, I'll be doing this talk out there.
For Northwest Flower. Yeah.
It'd be nice to actually meet you in person.
For sure. For sure. I'll see you then.
Great.
Joy.
Thank you, Charlie. He's so fun. If this episode got your wheels turning about this whole concept of perennial edible gardening, it really did for me because I really thought my edible garden needed to be all annuals. You can check out Charlie and his book. It's all linked in the show notes. And if you're dreaming up your own continuous garden, tag me on Instagram at Growing Joy with Maria. I'd love to see what you're growing. Until next time, my sweet plant friends, keep tending, keep experimenting, keep playing around with your garden and how you're going to plan to make 2026 your best garden season yet. And of course, keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.